Hello, this is Jeff Mervis with Science Magazine. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to be discussing undergraduate science and math education. You'll be hearing from three distinguished academics who have been very active in improving STEM education. That's an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that you'll probably hear used a lot this morning on campuses across the United States and around the world. They will help us to understand what's right and what's wrong with the current system. Perhaps they'll also suggest where we might be headed. I want to introduce the three people. You'll be hearing from Daniel Goroff, Stephanie Fearman, and Michael Summers. Dr. Goroff is Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty at Harvey Mudd College, which is part of the Claremont University Consortium in California. He also co-directs the Scientific and Engineering Workforce Project at the National Bureau of Economic Research. A mathematician, Goroff was a faculty member at Harvard for more than 20 years and has examined a range of science policy issues during stints at the National Research Council and the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Dr. Fearman is Hirshhorn Professor and Chair of the Department of Environmental Science at Barnard College in New York City. Her current interests include research on the environmental aspects of sea ice in the Arctic and the development of women scientists and interdisciplinary scholars. She is also president-elect of the Council of Environmental Deans and Directors. Dr. Summers is a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and also an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. His research focuses on NMR studies of proteins, including those that comprise the human immunodeficiency virus. He has led efforts to develop programs for retaining minority students in the sciences and received the White House Presidential Award for Science, Mathematics, and Engineering Mentoring. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Jeff.
Let me start with a question, and I hope that we will have a good discussion. The poor performance of U.S. students in science and math in elementary and secondary schools has been thoroughly documented, and there are many programs aimed at addressing these problems. Higher education, in contrast, is an area in which most people feel that the United States has traditionally gotten it right. Is that still the case, or is there cause for concern about the health of STEM education in our nation's 4,000 colleges and universities? Daniel, do you want to start with that?
I think we have been getting it right, but there's no such thing as getting it right in perpetuity. The world is changing very quickly. Science is changing very quickly. And while we've had a kind of winner-take-all attitude towards these things, where we've had a small percentage of the world's population, but a huge fraction of the science and technology and advances that have been done in this country, all of that is really changing, and we have to adjust accordingly, so that we're not just paying attention to the very top, that we're not just doing this kind of winner-take-all where the United States is able to dominate everything, because that won't be the case in the same way as we move forward. So as things change, I think we absolutely have to adjust, and I see a lot of signs that we're going in the right direction.
Now, Stephanie and Michael, you are at different sorts of institutions. How do you see that winner-take-all model playing out at a public university like UMBC versus a private women's college like Barnard? Michael?
Well, at UMBC, we still get large numbers of applicants from international students to our graduate program. So it's clear that foreign students consider the education system in the U.S. to be a good system. The problem that I see that this country faces is that we're not seeing that same interest among our own students, students that are educated in the U.S., that are coming into college. Things are changing to some extent, but it's really an issue, I think, of interest and retention among our own students.
Mm-hmm. And Stephanie?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. At the graduate level, I think we're doing a good job, and we are attracting, you know, foreign students as well as really training high-caliber graduates. But at the undergraduate level, my concern is this general anti-science trend that's kind of pervading the country right now is something that we're seeing in our students as well. And we need to do a lot more to show everyone, basically, the importance and the interest in science. You know, show them that it's an intellectually stimulating field where they can have adventure. And it's not this sort of isolated, you know, away in your lab doing something completely separate from society. And I think that would make a really big difference.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges facing an institution that wants to increase the number of its students majoring in STEM fields? You all are involved in programs, and I'm interested in how you see those issues differing according to the type of institution and the makeup of the student body. Mike?
Well, our classes tend to be fairly large. UMBC is kind of a medium-sized research institution. We have about 12,000 students on our campus. So our freshman courses, the so-called gateway courses, tend to be fairly large, and we might have 300 or 400 students in a session of a freshman chemistry, and even that's small compared to a lot of other larger institutions. So the problem that we see is that you get students that are coming into our gateway courses, and there really are large numbers of students that are coming out of the K-12 system who are starting college with an interest in science, engineering, and math. And what happens, I think, is they get turned off very quickly. They get into these big courses. They haven't really figured out yet what it takes to excel at the college level. They may know how to excel at the high school level, and especially if you're from a population in the U.S. that isn't necessarily represented well in the sciences, and you look around you and you see other people performing well, it can be disheartening. And so I think what's happening is we're not retaining our brightest students in those freshman courses.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume that the large courses are driven by economics. Is there anything you can do to mitigate that problem with size?
Well, absolutely. There are several places around the country that have experimented with different kinds of programs, and we're doing the same thing here. It's well known from work done at historically black colleges and minority-serving institutions and other places that bridge programs can have a very positive impact on retention. These are programs where students will come out of high school and spend a summer doing some coursework and some research and other on-campus activities prior to the start of the freshman curriculum. The problem is those are expensive and hard to broadly apply. So if there are ways of incorporating bridge-like elements into the gateway courses, those sorts of changes seem to be having a positive effect at several places.
Now, Danny, I'm guessing that preparation is less of a problem for your students at Harvey Mudd, but what's the freshman experience like, and what are the pluses and minuses when a student wants to go into a STEM field?
Well, at Harvey Mudd College, many of the students, really all of them, come expecting to do something in a STEM field. And so that we have the advantage of a very, very strong core program where they take lots and lots of different courses in computer science, in physics, in mathematics, in chemistry, so that they're really ready for anything going forward. And that eliminates the problem that many other universities have of getting the prerequisites in place. And they do have a sense that they're then ready to address the big problems of the world, which we help them do later in their careers. But I think anything that we can do that, as Stephanie was saying before, takes people away from this myth of a lone genius, and that's what it takes to succeed, is really important. So anything that makes for connected communities and helps people see that science is done in connected communities rather than lone people away in an office really helps with the retention problem that we were talking about before. And as Mike said, it's not just the best of these students who are going on. In other words, some of the best students are dropping out. We have to pay attention to the opportunity costs for them in this country compared to other countries and make sure that they see right from the beginning, right from that freshman course, how exciting this can be, how much of a community effort it can be, and how you can really address the important problems of the world.
I think in many liberal arts settings, most student exposure to science is through a science requirement. Many liberal arts colleges have something like this, and so students have to take a science class. And these tend to be, often the classes are sort of dumbed down science or trying to serve a lot of different people in when they're put together. And what I think might be a more effective approach to address the issues that we've been talking about is if we can attempt to infuse science more across the curriculum, so it's not isolated into these, you know, special classes that you sort of have to take. I'm talking for the people who aren't already engaged and interested in it. And we've done this in a first-year seminar class at Barnard that has had traditionally been offered by English professors and professors in the humanities and some social sciences. And several of us in the sciences said, well, why not offer a first-year seminar in the sciences? And it's been really interesting because what you see is you have a combination of students in that class, of students who were already interested in science, but then also some students who just were attracted by the subject matter. And when we do surveys at the end, they all see that there's a greater connection between science and society. They see more of a role for science in their own lives. And we've done it by sort of sneaking in the science along with the other subject matter. And I think that, for many students, that's going to be the best way to engage them.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add to what Stephanie just
sure.
said, we're seeing larger numbers of students starting in our freshman chemistry courses who are interested in forensics. I mean, significant increases. And I think that there are significant numbers of students who are starting college with some interest in science, and part of it is because of it's been a very pleasant change to see what the people are seeing on television.
If I can just add to that, what we're talking about is very, very important, not just for the retention and the training of future scientists and engineers, but also future teachers. And that introductory required course may be the last interaction that future teachers have with science or mathematics or engineering. And so the impressions that they get about it will be transmitted to students for generations to come. And I think it's another good reason why those kinds of efforts have a lot of payoff.
Exactly.
Okay. Speaking of curriculum, and I want to come back to the preparing teachers also later, but let's stay focused on curriculum. How hard is it to change the curriculum, to change an introductory course, to develop an interdisciplinary course? And what are the limiting factors? Is it time? Is it resources? Is it faculty resistance? Could each of you address that from your own perspective and then more broadly?
Well, I think part of it is knowing what to do. I think that the NSF has funded pilot projects. Howard Hughes Medical Institute has put money into their biological sciences initiatives. These are basically experiments conducted at lots of different places that are designed to modify the curriculum, make biology more quantitative, for example. And I think what's needed now are the data that show the impact of those programs. Have certain metrics been met? Have there been quantitative changes in retention, for example, or performance? And I think that people will be at other institutions would look at that information and use it as a guide for their own curriculum. I think that's one thing that should probably be done now.
Is that a way to overcome a not invented here syndrome? How big a problem is that?
How big a problem is what?
Is doing something and then scaling up so that other institutions who have not developed it themselves are willing to take it on and apply it?
Well, you might talk to the dean about that because these things sometimes cost money.
they do cost money, but my experience is that if you make things fun and interesting and intellectually engaging, this whole process of how people learn, we're finding out so much about that, and that faculty find that really very engaging and are willing to do it. One of the problems with the curriculum is that it's very interconnected and is changing quickly. And so to change one little piece of it becomes quite a challenge. It's the sort of thing where one faculty member working on their own may find it difficult to really make the kind of impact that they would like. But again, if we think about ourselves as a community and take these things on and share the results and are careful and thoughtful about measuring the results of these, then with the help of friends at the National Science Foundation and Howard Hughes and many of the private foundations, I think there's a lot that can be done. And this myth about curriculum being impossible to change, I don't see that.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Go ahead.
Yeah, faculty really want to do a good job at what they do. And
hear, hear.
Many of us spend a lot of time teaching, and we really, you know, are gratified when the student evaluations come back and we see that we were effective. And so to go back to this, knowing what to do, I think, is absolutely critical. And that's not just, you know, what kind of content should be delivered or is appropriate, but also how to deliver the material, and then also how to assess it, and how to, you know, work with the students on different ways of understanding exactly what they've learned so that you can do even a better job next time. And I think that faculty time is necessary at the outset to make the investment in learning all of this. But what would really help is if there were some way that we could find out more about what's out there, that the best practices. And a lot of people have been experimenting, as we've been talking about, with different things. And some things I know have worked, I've heard anecdotally, but my recent experience, I was just looking around to try to find a specific lab. We changed something in the class, and I needed to introduce a lab on a certain type of material. And so I was trying to find it, and it was a fairly basic concept. And I couldn't find anything on the web, either by searching the literature or by searching the online resources. And that really was eye-opening to me. You know, I thought that people had been posting things and that I would be able to find something out there, and I wasn't able to. So I think that would really help a lot, too.
Well, what would you all recommend for a faculty member who wants to make a change but doesn't know where to start or where to look?
Well, Stephanie has, the right idea. I mean, so let's say this is what's happened here. We realize we had a retention problem in chemistry, or I mean, it's not a problem that anybody else doesn't have, but we wanted to try to retain more students. And so since bridge programs work, what we decided, and a major element of bridge programs is teaching students how to study, both independently and in groups. And so we looked at other places, for example, Delaware, how White has been pioneering small group problem-solving components to his lecture courses. And we've implemented those things here. Now, these cost money because you have to set up a class to do these, and you have students working in small groups. That this is complementary to the main lecture series. And so there's a lot of effort. There's money. You need TAs that can be in these large, you know, large rooms where people are working in small groups. But it took something. I mean, we had the faculty here that were involved had to go to the administration and free up some space and some money to test this experiment. And some money came from the NSF to help try this as well. But we're documenting the outcomes. And once that information is on the web, what I would hope then is that other faculty that would want to do the same thing could take that information and go to their own dean and show them the charts and say, this is what has happened at Delaware, this is what's happened at UMBC, and we can do the same thing here. And I think that if a faculty member can go to the web and get that information and then take those data to their administrators, then they have more power to free up the resources to do what they want to do.
I'd like to encourage faculty to get involved with national groups also. This is not the kind of problem that's easy to solve just one person at a time, and it doesn't make sense to reinvent the wheel, much less the flat tire. So if you think about Project Kaleidoscope, for example, is a national network of especially young faculty who are sharing ideas like this all the time, comparing notes, making connections. That's extremely valuable. Project Next in mathematics is a similar effort, and I've just seen the effects of those just leverage lots and lots of good work that's going on around the country.
Similarly, the National Science Foundation has been funding workshops in different areas, and I know one of our faculty members has gone to two teaching hydrology workshops over the past 10 years, and he's found them extraordinarily valuable.
Okay, well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about each of those programs. Let me start with Mike. UMBC is one of several institutions that are trying to increase retention rates, as you mentioned, among racial groups traditionally underrepresented in STEM fields, and as well as across the board, and also narrow the achievement gap. Can you tell us how that initiative began and whether you feel you're making headway and how you're measuring that?
Sure. So this was really started by our president, Freeman Hrabowski. He's one of only a few black presidents who are presidents of majority institutions in this country. And his premise when he started the program 20 years ago was that there are large numbers of high-achieving minority students, in particular African-Americans, that were just not being retained in science. And it's a hypothesis that cuts against the traditional views of me, were my views and my colleagues, which is even today that most of us think that there are small numbers of minorities who are interested in science, and the ones that are smart and interested go to medical school. And so he took the opposite approach, that there were large numbers, and he went after those high-achieving students, high-achieving in the high schools. And he approaches them even when they're freshmen and sophomores, when they've taken their PSATs, if they do well, he brings them to campus with their families, and we start talking to them about PhD research and the doctoral, the PhD degree, rather than just the MD degree. And so we've been doing this for 20 years now. We have we graduated at over 500 students who've large percentages have gone on to graduate and graduate schools around the country. And it's had it's been extremely successful. Well over 85% of the students that enter the program graduate with science and engineering and math degrees. And what's significant is there are people that have said, well, you know, you're going after the most talented. Of course, they're going to succeed. Well, Freeman did a very interesting thing. He decided we're going to quantitate this experiment, and we're going to do controls. And the major control that he does is when we bring about 200 students to campus for selection weekend, and we'll make about 100 offers, knowing that 50 will join this program, and these are full scholarships. What we do is before we make any student an offer, their parents will sign a waiver that says if we make your student an offer and you turn us down to go someplace else, and these are very competitive students, so they get offers from everywhere. So they turn us down to go to an Ivy League or another school, that we'll be able to track them. And, of course, their parents want to get the offer, so they sign the form. So now we have a database of, we'll make 100 offers and half the students come here, half go elsewhere. So it turns out that if they qualified for our program, they were nominated, they're high achievers, they're interested in science, and they go elsewhere, they're half as likely to graduate with a science, engineering, or math degree, and they're more than five times less likely to go to graduate school. So the program is having a very positive effect. And it starts with the summer bridge, and it involves getting students into research labs with mentors right away.
Have you identified specific elements that make the difference between how they're successful at UMBC and less successful at other schools, including top schools around the country?
Well, we haven't done a detailed assessment of all of the experiences that the students have when they go elsewhere, but we do keep track of the experiences that seem most important here. And the top thing, I think, is making sure that they're academically successful in the freshman courses. So you don't want students to come in. I mean, a lot of these kids have had AP classes, advanced placement classes in high school, and they could place out of, for example, chemistry, but they take the freshman courses, they are strongly encouraged to make high A's, and most of them do. They tend to be academically very successful in the freshman year, and I think that's critical, because if you're successful in the freshman year, then the research faculty are eager to involve you in their labs. If you're a mediocre student academically, then there's more concern about getting you involved, because there's a chance you may have to drop out of the lab to take care of your coursework. So if you're academically successful in the freshman year, then you're much more attractive to the faculty, the research faculty, and you have many more opportunities. And then things just tend to build from there.
What if they're not? What kind of sort of intervention or support do you provide to them?
So there are counselors, and in the first semester on campus, these counselors keep track of every pop quiz and test that the students take. If a student has trouble right in the beginning, they're immediately paired up with other classmates. I mean, because of the summer bridge, they already have developed relationships with other people in their groups. They kind of know who's really good in calculus and who's really good in chemistry. And so they develop support groups where they can help each other. And then we have senior classmen that we pay as mentors to help them as well. So the students get a lot of attention. And then if those things don't work, the parents are involved. We'll call the parents. because there's a parent association that provides money and time and things like that to help make this program work.
So you're embedding them in a whole community.
Oh, absolutely. What Freeman says is when he brings them in as freshmen, he says, look to your left, look to your right. If one of them is not there at the end of the year, you failed. I mean, this is a group effort.
Mm-hmm. And how much does it cost to run the program? And is that an issue for other institutions that might be interested in doing the same thing?
Yes, it's expensive because we pay the we don't pay quite full tuition anymore, but for a long time it was full tuition. We pay housing, books, things like that. It does cost money. But many of these students are from families where they would actually have to work and take out loans and work during the summer and do other things in order to put themselves through school. So the summer bridge costs money. We have teachers and counselors, and there are other activities that are involved there as well. So the last, you can pretty much figure out yourself whatever it costs on your campus for tuition, room, and board, and a little bit of money for books. That's what it costs per year per student. So we're constantly spending money or spending time on fundraising efforts.
Would this be a larger program if you had more money, or do you feel you're at the right level in terms of size and resources?
How many so you have to be nominated to get into this program. How many nominations do you think we get every year for high-achieving, high school students? We get almost 2,000 nominations
Wow.
a year. We get 800 applications a year, and 80% of them are from Maryland. Now, Maryland is a small state. If you think about large areas like L.A. or Detroit, I mean, there's this enormous untapped talent pool that we're just not retaining.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, a lot of people have criticized the program, or maybe criticism isn't the right word, have said you have an advantage because you're cherry-picking. If that's not the case, why does that attitude persist?
Well, we certainly are taking students who are the most likely to succeed academically based on their high school performance. But again, we're only taking a small fraction of the students that come. And actually, if you look at some aspects of the SAT tests, the students that go elsewhere by some measures are better academically than the students that come to UMBC. So you're right, in a way we're cherry picking. But we don't apologize for that because our goal is to produce minority leadership. And we feel the best way to produce minority leadership is to go after those who are best prepared and most likely to do that. I mean, and again, 80% of these students are from Maryland. So if we've got that many cherries in Maryland, people should be cherry picking all over the country.